the king, with the support of a section of the ruling class and its political representatives, appointed Mussolini as the prime minister. And once in control of political power, the fascisti, or the fascists, were able to consolidate their rule with Mussolini as dictator, and then they eventually dissolved parliament and banned other political parties. In Germany, a similar ultra-nationalist anti-democratic movement called itself the National Socialist German Workers' Party, or Nazis. They were called fascists, but they didn't call themselves that. That wasn't the name they gave to themselves. They were able to gain considerable popular and electoral support in the early 30s, about one third of the voters. And this was as a result of the failure of the democratic and reformist parties to solve the problems that were caused by capitalism, in particular the mass unemployment in the slump that followed the Wall Street crash of October 1929. Now, they too came to power constitutionally when the German president, with the approval of other politicians, appointed Herr Hitler as chancellor in 1933. From this position of control of state power, the Nazis were able to ban all other parties and trade unions and install Hitler as dictator. They were, in fact, able to do this much quicker than Mussolini had been. Now, one thing that Italy and Germany had in common was that they were relatively recently unified states. I mean, Italy, it was 1870, and Germany, it was 1871. Now, as a result, feelings of national unity were not as strong as in the longer established states such as Britain and France. And the more virulent nationalism there reflected the ruling class's need for a stronger central state that could overcome the remaining regionalist loyalties. In the case of Germany, its attempt in 1914 to get a place in the sun in line with its industrial and trading strength was inevitably going to be at the expense of Britain and France, which had already, of course, carved out substantial colonial empires for themselves. I mean, this attempt had failed. But the problem remained for their capitalist class, and any second attempt was going to be more aggressive because more desperate, and this proves to be the case. So fascism, then, in its proper sense, was an interwar, interworld war of the last century, but confined to that particular historical period. And I don't think it's going to repeat itself because the conditions of that time are not going to. There isn't a section of the ruling class which is prepared to allow dictators to come to power constitutionally. So in this sense, classical fascism, it isn't a threat. So why are there anti-fascists, and why is anti-fascism bandied about today? Now, anti-fascism was one of the ideologies under which Britain and France, later aided by the United States, fought the Second World War to see off Germany's second attempt to find a place in the sun at their expense. Somewhat ironically, it was also the ideology under which their ally, Russia, fought its war of which power, which great power, or large power in the area, Germany or Russia, should dominate Eastern Europe. I mean, I say ironically, because apart from the anti-Semitism, the Russian dictatorship was the mirror image of the German one. They had the same leader worship, the same mass rallies, the same concentration camps. As a result, there have been two kinds of anti-fascism, one in defense of political democracy, the other in defense of the Russian dictatorship. Now, the situation is confused by the fact that those who supported the Russian dictatorship employed the same arguments as those who were in defense, the same arguments, the same language as those who were in defense of democracy. So some anti-fascists haven't really been anti-fascists, if this is defined as opposition to a one-party dictatorship. But anyway, who today wants to replace political democracy by a one-party or a one-man dictatorship? I mean, not even the far-right parties do. There are still some classical fascist groups around, but they haven't got any support. The support is negligible. All political parties today with any degree of electoral support now favour governments being chosen through parliamentary and or presidential elections. So I think it's a historical anachronism to describe today's far-right parties, which do have considerable support, as fascists. Now, it's true that they've been infiltrated by fascists in the same sort of way as left-wing parties are infiltrated by Trotskyists, but you wouldn't call the Labour Party Trotskyist just because there were some Trotskyists in it. So these parties are not fascists, in my opinion. I mean, their ideas are still objectionable and dangerous, but they need to be opposed on some other basis than being called fascist. Now, far-right parties have grown in recent decades as a result, I think, of two things. Their opposition to immigration into their countries to solve the problems that ordinary people face. Now, as these problems are caused by the capitalist economy, the capitalist economic system's need to put profit-making ahead of meeting people's needs, government formed by these conventional parties are doomed to fail, and they always do. The far-right parties have been able to exploit this to convince considerable numbers of people. But the reason these other parties fail is because they are incompetent, corrupt, and self-seeking, in much the same way as the classical fascists in the interwar period of the last century were able to convince people that their problems were caused by political democracy and not by capitalism. As I said, the main reason why these parties have attracted support is their opposition to immigration. I mean, they're xenophobic, racist, nationalist parties, and that is the basis on which they should be challenged. Well, the next question arises, how should they be challenged? Now, basically, what's involved is a battle of ideas, and such battles can only be fought with leaflets, pamphlets, books, meetings, and nowadays websites, podcasts, social media, you know, like we're doing this evening. And that's the only way to change ideas. You don't change ideas by physically fighting with those who hold them, nor by taking action, legal or extra legal, to stop people expressing these views or promoting them. And that's why no platforming far-right organizations is not the way and is even counterproductive. I mean, stopping them holding meetings, breaking them up, refusing to let others debate with them, they're not going to change, you know, the people they call fascists. It's not going to change their ideas. In fact, it's more likely to reinforce them. I mean, physically confronting far-rightists, turning their demonstrations into street brawls or beating up their members is even less effective. And besides, it reduces politics generally to the more primitive level of settling disagreements by fighting rather than by voting. Of course, insofar as there are fringe groups and deranged individuals who physically attack immigrants, as happens from time to time, or quite regularly, I think, nobody is going to object to self-defense groups, but that's a different issue to combating the ideology of far-right parties. So, I'll say no. The way to combat xenophobia and racism is not direct action to stop these views being expressed, but to challenge and confront them as mistaken and dangerous, even in public debate with groups that advocate them. And of course, we in the Socialist Party have done this. We debated before, or even with the British Union of Fascists. So what should be the content of the case against far-right ideas? I mean, it has to be more than just the general case that all humans are members of the same species with the same range of abilities and should be treated equally, which is, you know, basically that's what the Black Lives Matter movement is, its basic aim, basically what it's about. But I mean, this of course has to be an essential part, but it's not enough on its own. I mean, opposing these ideas cannot avoid bringing up the cause of the problems which ordinary people face and which the far-right parties wrongly attribute to, and to which they offer a mistaken solution. I mean, capitalism has to be mentioned, and it has explained that the way out is to establish socialism as a world of common ownership, democratic control, production to directly to meet people's needs and not for profit, and distribution on the basis of from each according to their abilities to each according to reason. You know, in short, socialism properly understood. Now, the trouble is that most anti-fascists, even those calling themselves socialists, are not anti-capitalism. They may be opposed to sections of the capitalist class or to capitalists or to capitalist corporations, but they're not opposed to capitalism as a system. In fact, they think that the problems ordinary people face could be solved within the profits, wages, money system, but that is capitalism. I mean, this is a serious weakness, as far as they're concerned, when it comes to making a case against the far right, since it rules out making the point that one reason for the far right's party's rise in recent years is precisely the failure, in fact, the impossibility of the conventional parties to solve these problems. I mean, they can't solve them because they're seeking solutions within the framework of capitalism. And doing that is, in fact, contributing to a situation which the far right parties can benefit from. I mean, of course, they're saying that the far right parties themselves are no more capable than the conventional parties of solving these problems within capitalism. Now, the other weakness is that most anti-fascists are nationalists, and that means that they accept that the world is and should be divided into separate national groups, which are entitled to inhabit a particular part of the globe and whose members share a common interest. Now, nations have been correctly described as imagined communities whose members are divided, in fact, into antagonistic classes. I mean, the capitalists who own the means of life, who are the ruling class, and the rest who work for them for wages. I mean, nationalism is, in fact, the ideology through which a national ruling class obtains and maintains the support and acquiescence of those they rule over. So the national interest is their interest. Now, this is a misconception that anti-fascists share with the far right. I mean, it means that nationalist anti-fascists are combating the ideas of the far on the far right's territory. And that's, for instance, when it comes to arguing whether or not immigration is in the national interest. I mean, since the national interest of the capitalist class within each supposed nation could at some point be to have a immigration controls and discrimination against foreigners. I mean, if the far right can show that this is in the national capitalist interest, they win the argument. And of course, no capitalist state is going to throw open its borders to completely open borders. Anybody can come and live in their state. So to conclude, any campaign against the far right and its views, it has to be waged on the level of ideas, not physical attacks or legal or extra-legal bans. It has to be based on recognizing that capitalism is the cause of the problems that these far-right parties exploit to get support. And so is the cause, if you like, in the end, of the existence of these far-right parties. It also has to be based on the rejection of all nationalism, which xenophobia is just one end of the same spectrum. Xenophobic views should not be separated from the struggle for socialism, properly understood as a world without frontiers. I'm suggesting that to bring in fascism, which is something a past historical phenomenon, into this isn't helpful at all.